for getting behavioural fault propagation indexed in was must have been an uphill struggle for the guys who tried to get it in there, right? There will be similar uphill struggles, except now there'll be millions of electronic engineers beating up on the VHDL committee to try and put some of that stuff in future upgrades, whereas before there might have been 30 people in some group in a deck. So you're right, but in reality, I think it's not a backward step, and I can see sufficient other benefits to make it a worthwhile step forward.
Are there guidelines that you use to develop models?
We are not a company that develops models. As I was being a little forward, saying I was a vendor, we don't sell models. But there are such standards, and that's what I wanted to address was modeling methodologies. It's a very important problem, and it's not just here that people think it's an important problem. There is a subcommittee of the VHDL Analysis and Standardization Group which is dedicated to the problem of modeling methodologies. The first recommended practice in IEEE terminology that they have come up with is a recommended practice for a logic model. It is a nine-state. The seven-state model has been expanded to nine. And it does include don't care states, a don't care state. And there's pretty wide agreement that that model is adequate for component modeling and for cell modeling, which is what it was designed for. Now, there are other modeling standards that have to be layered on top of that, the first of which is under development. That's a timing standard. How exactly do you represent timing in a VHDL model so you can recognize it and manipulate it in a part that has generic timing parameters? So that would be the next step. But there is a logic model, and there's pretty wide agreement on it.
Well, another point, VHDL.
Have some input or some feedback mechanism to that subcommittee so that we can affect their standards.
That's certainly one area. The other area is VHDL Consulting does publish or sell a VHDL modeling methodology guide. It's about 100 pages long, and in fact, I haven't really seen it, but they profess it to be the guidelines that they would like to see. So we have several sources, and actually the committees we can interact with for those, but I think it's very important of adopting some acceptable modeling guidelines. And yeah, at some point we may have to make some decisions and say it doesn't meet the guidelines, but I need the damn part to get the product out. I also think that we're doing the company a disservice if we don't stand up and say these are the certain minimum things that you're going to have to do in a model to play in our game. And Jack should be able to wield enough monetary economic power to get people to listen to us. And I'll know within the next month and a half, when I sit down again with Logic Automation, without the Dexim rock standing between us, and talk to them about those specific issues.
It's just we may have more luck affecting the standard, and then the standard represents the whole industry.
Sure. See, I don't see us here, though, going outside of why should we be really any different in what most people will require in their VHDL model. So you're absolutely right, affecting the standard is a way to go about it. And if we stood up and said, well, here's a standard that's being developed, and guess what? If you don't meet that standard, then we're not going to buy models from you. Which then is a industry global standard, even carries more effect. And I think Shahid was right that it's not going to be just DEC screaming and yelling about these things. I mean, you're talking about the entire industry. And I think that's going to make these enhancements and improvements to the VHDL simulators occur much faster than they would if we didn't have that standard across the industry, because it says now that every CAE vendor, in order to play in the VHDL tools game, is going to have to meet these standards, including the simulator. If they don't, I mean, Shahid is just flat stating, if you don't comply 100%, go away. I mean, now that's one area in deck, but he's going to stick by that. And I think that sends a message out to those vendors that I can't play the subset game. I've heard today, you know, a Synopsys who has a subset superset, and I did identify some pain with people trying to deal with, here's VHDL 1076 standard, these companies support it, and then here's Synopsys. It says, well, we don't do all, you know, we only do this, and oh, by the way, you have to give us this other information. is, in the long run, going to hurt synopsis. I just heard a level of pain today in that. So I think the pressure of meeting those standards is going to be applied across the industry. We shouldn't be any really different than anyone else.
That's not to say it isn't a pity, in my opinion, that we're not, we as digital aren't on the list of people who are early participants in the VHDL standardization process. We as digital aren't participating particularly closely in the VASG and those sorts of activities. You know, it's one of the pities, I think, that we as an organization don't seem capable of making that kind of central decision very effectively.
I'd like to just jump back a minute and address a question that Jim Finnerty asked before about what's possible to do with models to enhance testability issues. I can't really speak for all of digital, but I can just speak from personal experience. And I don't profess to have all the answers, but I would think that a place to start would be to give me as a module test guide a way to move the outputs of an ASIC without large volumes of test vectors. The reason I say that is if I take a look at some of the fault spectrums that I've seen, at least in some of the low-end plants, the majority of defects tend to be solder process defects.
Sorry?
Solder process defects are the largest fault spectrum. Now, It's great to get internal visibility in ways of propagating faults from dense LSI to the boundaries, but the fact remains that that's a very small piece of my fault spectrum. And I can get the biggest bang for the buck by somebody giving me a way to easily toggle pins from the chip out through to the node.
Well, VHDL certainly doesn't, VHDL is...
As a model methodology, not as a...
As a model methodology, I'd question how much that was useful unless the silicon actually had the same functionality. And there, really, the call is that do the designers that we represent want to put those testability features in? Because clearly, you know, I can give you a model, and frankly, in the simulator, I can poke any internal state into any value I feel like. But the question is, are our engineers who are actually designing the product, are they prepared to put the features that you need?
Right, that's what I'm addressing. The usefulness of a VHDL model in manufacturing test is only for internally designed components. If I'm trying to mimic something that I bought externally by writing my own model, that doesn't help me a bit. But if somebody's designing an ASIC using VHDL, and you put this simple 1-0 toggling mechanism in that model, and it goes through to the LSI, I get an easy way to deal with continuity testing out to the node.
I'll another answer to Jim's question. I think when you start to have these textual high-level languages, it shouldn't be very hard for a designer to whip up some macros that will, with a small amount of work, generate the source code for a JTAG scan chain. And I think that addresses the module test question. So if you want to write a fun tool that lets you read the pin list right out of Spider and construct the source code for the JTAG scan chain, so much the better. It's not a critical item. You may have been asking more about testability inside the ASIC where the synthesis is being performed. And my answer in that case is to say in our ASICs we are throwing in JTAG for the external work. In the internal, the use of VHDL synthesis should not make the testability problem any worse than it is with less use of synthesis in the traditional design method.
Actually, I don't think that has not been my observation.
No, I'm saying that's the goal. That should be the requirement, is don't make the testability problem worse. And that's important to, I wouldn't put it as extremely important for VHDL synthesis to eliminate more testability problems than human designers do today.
I think I'd agree with that.
I should state a mechanism behind that. I would be satisfied if the VHDL synthesis spit out a design that would put through a testability analysis, and I'm happy with manual feedback. The testability analysis said this area of logic is hopelessly untestable and told me to go to schematic.
schematic page 5, I look there and see that the synthesis has produced redundant logic. Of course, some kind of cross-reference of synthesized logic might be helpful to find this bad logic so I can go back, but the essential thing for HDL synthesis is for you to be able to tweak the source code to fix the problem. Synthesis needs to be controllable from the HDL source.
I don't think that the problem, surprisingly, I don't think that the problem is redundant logic. In fact, I would expect that a good logic synthesis tool would create less redundant logic than a manual designer might, because it can spend more time evaluating more optimization possibilities. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is that people are lured into a false sense that synthesis will solve all their problems for them, and they're rather cavalier about the way they create their models. And a good example of that is an address line, an address bus coming in. Not all of the addresses may be stimulatable from the outside world. Maybe only a subset of them are. That is to say, not 2 to the n are possible, where you have an n-bit address line. But no one happens to tell the logic synthesis tool that this following address range can never happen. And so the logic that's synthesized is general enough to handle all 2 to the n inputs, and you're going to have logic in your design which cannot be stimulated from the outside world, which corresponds exactly to untestable logic. So in that sense, the power of logic synthesis can lure people into being a little bit careless about the way they describe their designs in a way that maybe they wouldn't be if they were creating it manually.
Yeah, extraneous inputs to a gate, that's what I meant by redundant logic.
Okay. In fact, I have evidence of that. I mean, we've done a lot of logic synthesis using BDS, but that's exactly what we found. I remember one model written by one of the guys. He was having some problem with it, so I was taking a look at it, and I thought he'd coded it in a particularly ugly way. Although I had no conception as to whether the gate count was reasonable or not, and I recoded it in a more easy-to-read fashion, and the gate count dropped from 800 to 50. And there were 16 replications of this block in the system, so it had quite an impact on the overall gate count. And the guy was shocked, so was I. But when we looked at it, we realized it was exactly the problem that Jim Finty had just said, where he didn't tell the system. When he coded it in, he coded it in so that it behaved correctly behaviorally, but the point was half the time, it wasn't an address decoder, but it was like an address decoder. Half of the address bits weren't used. So he was saying things like, if the address is greater than 0 but less than 10,000 hex, then do something. Whereas all he needed to say was, is bit 15 set or clear? Yeah? And so Aladdin was going off, or the synthesis tool was going off and generating, you know, like a 16-bit wide comparator or some equivalent function. But clearly that's, a human can look at that and say, hey, you know, that's not good. And of course that might well have resulted in a pretty bad logic to test.
Jim, that's exactly what we want the high-level synthesis preprocessor to tackle, is
mathematical
optimizations.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't see your hand go up, Jim.
I'll raise another issue that we've kind of addressed a little bit. It gets right to what you're saying. I've got a group of very good hardware designers who don't know diddly about software, who don't know how to write structured code. What are we going to do to help them learn to write code that will be synthesizable at all and turn to something useful?
I think the first thing is for the synthesis people to actually write down very clearly what they expect certain sorts of constructs to result in. Now, I'm trying to be very careful here because at the end of the day, it's actually quite hard to do some of those things, but certainly guidelines like the case that I just related, those are the sorts of things that, you're right, a hardware engineer won't typically think of. It comes with bitter experience, but hopefully in the future it will come with training and or documentation.
I guess what I'm also looking for is some macro libraries of functions. We talk about reasonable code a lot, and it doesn't happen in hardware very often, but I think VHDL will be a way to generate reasonable code so that you get compact things out of it easily. I'm also interested in what I think of as case tools. Decision use pairs, trees, redefinition pairs, all the things you get with software that there's really no
nothing that I've ever seen in Dexamil doing to tell me how good a job I've done testing this code. And I'd like to see the same thing VHDL. That would also be something very valuable.
One of the tools that we're looking at helping hardware designers to get over the hurdle is something that John is also very interested in, is the graphical input capability. And that is one of the things that we're looking at implementing to incorporate into our system, to have the designers actually enter the designs in a state chart format. And it's a lot easier to understand, and it's a lot easier to learn. And that's just one way of doing that. And there's also other company is giving out macros of certain designs and high-level macros of certain hardware functions as building blocks, actually in VHDL form. So maybe that's another way of doing that.
I'm hoping that some of the people will raise their hands now and say, we'll develop a library of reusable code units.
Well, you can have access to any of the code that I've got.
I'm sorry?
You can have access to any of the code that I've got, VHDL models of Future Bus Plus, anything that we've got, we can share.
I'm talking like, hopefully we can figure out a way to modularize the design such that it can be done. For me to take your whole model, I'll never understand.
Yeah, but that's, you're right.
You mentioned that you'd already created some LSE templates for the various parts. That might be a good starting point. To help them with creating standards.
If people mail me or whatever, or if I remember, I'll actually put it in the notes file, the source code.
Did you have a question?
Just a couple comments on Jim's probe testability. The approach on the Aquarius project was to design the test structures at system level, and the individual engineer are solving the synthesis with it. And that kind of gets everybody off.
What is that? Was with Scepter, yeah?
So Scepter develops test vectors more than test structures, but the test structures themselves are put into the chips by synthesis and into arrays without any external interference.
I think I'd look for a. This may be, my Luddite hat on, but I think at the moment, I'm not sure I'd trust a system like that as much as I'd hope to. Perhaps in a couple of years, somebody will convince me that I can let a synthesis tool go off and generate test structures for me. But I think, one of the things that you yourself perhaps are alluding to is the fact that half of the problem is not inserting the test structures, but actually connecting them up and using them once you get to the system level. You obviously have a tool that helps you do that. We don't, right? So I see that as a logic synthesis type issue more than a VHDL issue, and I think that the solutions for those don't really exist in an adequate production use form. I'm not saying it didn't work for you on the Aquarius development, but in my kind of environment, I think I'd find that we're not ready for that kind of thing yet. Is my suspicion.
Another comment about how to get engineers to use that stuff. We've got a lot of hard programmers, and that's why we still keep looking at design capture systems that are graphically based. Most of us would like to move most of them behind. We still use them because that's how engineers visualize what they do. And by giving them only structures in the simulator to deal with to use in the library, it could strongly influence them not to use structures that they couldn't build.
Right.
And I think that was one of the biggest disconnects we suffered was the disconnect between VES format and this traditional schematic version. We didn't have automated way to do that. The synthesizers get better. They can help us bridge that gap, but right now, there was no automated way to do that. But again, approaching the problem was saying, these are the things that we don't want to build.
Right.
Yeah. One possibility for inserting test structures is, for example, to insert a built-in self-test structure, which is a well understood but difficult problem because it involves a simulation component as well as a synthesis component. If we were to go ahead and do that, for example, something specifically for state machines that was to insert built-in self-test structures and perhaps have, I would expect, something on the order of 15% area overhead, is that something that, in your perception, engineering groups would be interested in using? Or is there a good reason why people haven't done that yet?
No, people do want to use it, but on an on-off-able basis.
Right.
They'll run it, and they say 15%, that sounds all right. Then they put it in, and then somebody says, oh, you've just gone over the budget of this die size. You better take that self-test out. You know, give us the feature, and we'll use it or not.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering, if the feature was made available, would it be used?
Yes.
Yeah.
Part of the testability question that you asked, and comments were made about the Aquarius, having been on the receiving end of that, I was involved in the test piece of the Aquarius, utilizing those data structures on the tester, specifically the translator, to do that. Because we had a process that was mostly automated from the design engineering piece all the way down through test, we could very quickly discover whether the structures that were being used were valid. And early enough on, that if they weren't, it was readily apparent that we were in trouble, and the design engineers and the team in general could take action against it. So if you have a relatively closed-loop process, it is safe to turn things loose because you're going to find out quickly enough before you're committed to hardware whether you're in trouble or not. If you're running completely open-loop, yeah, be careful.
One of the advantages to having some sort of do this is the engineer can't decide if he doesn't have room for test structures. If you give him macros to put in, he will decide he can't.
Unless he gets creative and decides to not use them, go around, which typically means I'm in trouble. I mean, engineers are by nature creative people. Bingo.
You're being polite there.
Jim, I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here too much, but I want to ask another question about this VHDL view issue. Clearly, the power of VHDL is in the fact that it is a standard and that hopefully a lot of, or all chip vendors will be supplying VHDL models with their chips in the future. And if we are developing internal tools that utilize a data format that is not a standard, aren't we then limiting ourselves in terms of our flexibility? I mean, I don't understand exactly what the power of this secondary data format is, and maybe it's something that you just can't circumvent, that everyone will have to create some secondary data format before they can actually use VHDL. I don't know what the issues are, but the point is that it seems to be throwing out all of what we get by using VHDL.
No, it's not. It's from the standpoint of a tool developer, I mean, from the standpoint of the process of converting VHDL into something usable by any process, be it, you know, simulation or something else, you have to go from a textual form, which you literally type in or gets generated from a state machine diagram, but somehow you get VHDL text as a starting point or as an intermediate point. And from that point, you have to interpret it. Some tool has to interpret it, has to analyze that source code and interpret it in a way which conforms to the VHDL specification. And VHDL view is really nothing more than a semantically correct interpretation of the VHDL source. So what you get is data structures in memory, which are a faithful interpretation of the VHDL source. If we all had to write code which parsed the ASCII file in every tool, would have to have a separate verification that it's implementing VHDL faithfully. Instead, you have an analyzer step which converts the text into this representation, which is faithful to the LRM, and from there you can play with it. So this internal representation is basically a software data structure with pointers and everything else that say, you know, here's an if node, and the condition is over here, and the then part is over here, and the else part is over there. So it's
what you're saying is that if tool A creates this format using the analyzer from CLSI, let's say, and tool B doesn't use CLSI's analyzer, then everything will still play.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, although it's not exactly true, it's almost entirely a performance issue, right? Do you want to have to keep doing the bulk of that recompilation work each time you run the tool? As an example, VHDL is a very hierarchical system. So, in the vSim environment, in the vSim simulator that we developed, what we stored in the library was effectively just a symbol table. We stored, for any unit that you compiled, we didn't have VHDLV, we didn't use the CLSI front end. We basically built a symbol table in there that said, this is the name of symbol, which is visible to the outside world, and this is its type. So that when we compiled another unit against it, we could easily reference that. So to that extent, VHDL view is merely a temporary convenience. It doesn't have any, and what I was saying, I think, earlier was that it's convenient in the sense that if all your tools happen to use the CLSI front end, you don't have to keep rerunning an analyzer each time. You run the analyzer once, stick it in the library, then everything can reach that already checked, already known good format. It's purely performance, I'd say.
Yeah. For two systems which conform to 100% of the VHDL spec, that's true.
Yeah.
For tools, one of which is 95% and one of which is 93%, that's not true. If you're tied to the same database, then you know you have precisely the same interpretation.
Yeah.
Additionally, there's some information that might be stored during analysis, for example, the most recently analyzed architecture, where if you have different tools, that information may be stored in VHDL view, but now if you have another tool that goes and reads the source, it doesn't have access to that information.
Correct.
And to the extent that the LRM refers to that as an important part in interpreting the source, that is important.
And that's where I was getting to when I said earlier on this afternoon about the potential of a screw-up between what you'd simulated and what you'd synthesized if the synthesis and the simulator didn't understand that library structure,
right,
and that library representation.
Changing gears a little bit here. Name I hear frequently, and I assume most of the people in here have heard frequently, is Larry Walker, and some of the work and leadership that he's providing in CAE domain, computer-aided engineering domain. What, if any, connection between each of your efforts and the direction that Larry Walker has been apparently trying to set? Who's tied in with him, and each of you would like to comment on that, please. Start with Mike. Sorry.
Was this the effort to move to point to C modeling?
Yeah, a single corporate strategy from what I understand.
Single
corporate strategy from what
I understand. My latest understanding is that's just a SEG only strategy. I didn't. That there was a move within Denver's organization to consolidate, since that became VSS, to consolidate mid-range CAD with SEGCAD. I don't believe that is happening at this point in time. They're starting to realize that they have two different needs. It is not consolidated like they had hoped it would. So that's my understanding of what's happening up there.
My understanding is that I've never heard of Larry Walker, so that probably tells you.
Thank you.
From our viewpoint, we participated quite heavily in the synthesis segment of that quote consolidation, and basically, we contributed as an equal member into where synthesis is going to go with the four different synthesis systems. And I think that group, if any, has really benefited from their discussions and probably have come to the best resolution of preventing overlap and duplication of work. Unfortunately, this may or may not be news, but Don Jones, who was heading that, is moving to Spitbrook as a job, and so I don't know where that puts it, unless Jim has any better information as to where that really puts that effort. It could fall apart again in four organizations go off and do their thing.
Well, at least one of the positive things that has come out of that effort is there have some areas where we were working on really identical or similar, very similar activities, in particular the UC Berkeley tools, which Aladdin is based on, which Occam is based on. and for that matter, which Synopsys has been is based on. We had the same basic problem of importing Unix code from UCB and figuring out how to make it compile under VMS and getting the bugs out and so forth. And we've now reached a point where the Occam guys have agreed that they'll go ahead and do that and then supply us with the source code when they're done. So we're delighted with that arrangement, and they're happy with that arrangement. So that's good. That much has come out of it. Other than that, I think really the changes, Larry Walker is not really setting corporate direction, as you said. He is setting for those three organizations, it's consolidated.